All right. Hi. Good morning, Javier. I'm a sexaholic. That's why I'm here on this call. Not because I'm a normal person. If I was a normal person, then I probably wouldn't be of very much use to you all. I'm no great gifted whatever. My main qualification here is that I'm a pervert in recovery. I'm a Jew. I try to be from Jew and Baruch Hashem. And I'm definitely a sexaholic and I'm definitely in recovery. And that's why life is good. Life wasn't very good before. It was very exciting, but it wasn't very good. And that's why I'm possibly of some value to people who are calling in, because people who are calling in, people who are, if you listen to the recording, particularly if you listen to more than 5 or 10 minutes, you're probably in some sort of trouble. And whether you're in trouble or getting out of trouble, you're still a person who has some problems and you want help. So thanks for listening. It feels nice for me to know that the stuff that I've gone through, since I'm not so scared, I'm able to share it with you. It might be of use to another person. That's tremendously gratifying. And it's a way for me to work my 12th step, which is one of the obviously very important steps. The steps are why I'm sober today. The 12 steps are the reason that Hashem has been, it's like the kli through which Hashem has been giving me a good life, thank God, for the past 20 years of recovery. Which I only engaged into because of pain, not because of greatness. I never came to recovery, ever, never came to recovery because I was a great man and devoted to Kedusha and Tahara. Yes, I was devoted to Kedusha and Tahara. Yes, absolutely, but that's not why I came to recovery. My devotion to Kedusha and Tahara and Aliyah in Madragas, Aliyah in Avodas Hashem, all those things caused me to act out more and more and more sexually, slowly over time. I never understood that. I always thought that fighting it is the purpose of the person, like it says in the Hakdama of Tzilas Yesharim, Nimsa Adam B'Milchama. You know, if you find yourself, if you look through the Vera Klal Chovas Adam B'Olamo, and if you look through the Chassidus Sfarim, if you look through the Sifrei Musar, if you look through the Torah itself in a very simple sense even, you'll see that the Adam is very significant. We're not animals. We're animals just do what they do. They die, and then they, do whatever, their nefesh probably gets recycled into another animal or something, and that animal does what it's supposed to do, and it's very simple. But a person actually has bechira, and our choices really, really matter. Animals don't really make choices. And therefore I always assumed that, it never occurred to me that I was sick. I always assumed that I was never taken out of the category the normal human being that I'm reading about in all these forums. I never thought that. So I explained in other talks, why I'm not in that category. I think the last talk that I gave last week, towards the end of the talk maybe, I explained as Hashem why and what I mean when I say that I came to the realization that I was out of the category of normal person and that slightly different rules applied to me. Namely, rules like I can't just stop and expect everything to go back to normal for two reasons. One, I won't just stop. That's That obviously, that's not happening. I saw over years and years, that's just not happening. And number two, there's something going on with me that infects the ways that I live in different ways than just sex specifically, and, you know, sexual behavior specifically, avarice and such. There's something going on in me and how I live. Basically, it's what the alcoholics discovered many years ago, that alcohol is not their problem. Sobriety is their problem. The alcoholics discovered a long time ago that their problem wasn't stopping drinking alcohol, and that they keep drinking and drinking. That's not their problem. Their problem is living in a sober state, living in abstinence from alcohol. It just becomes unbearable after a while, not because they miss alcohol so much, no, but because life, they're missing something in life. We are missing something in life that just makes it impossible to, we just get so uncomfortable that we need to relieve ourselves in some way. So if you stop your sexual behavior acting out, you're probably going to pick up another stupid addiction. And if you stop some other addiction, you might pick up sexual behavior. So it's something has to change inside us. A little bit like what the Rambam says in Hilchos Teshuva. And we talk about it in every laning of every tzom, of every tiny tzibur. We talk about that concept, that it's machshavos, the machshavos of that bring a person to hate have to change. So lots of people embark on a derech of Musar and Hasidus and, you know, whatever. And I found that that just made me worse and worse and worse, because I didn't understand what it meant to be abstinent, to stop, to be sober. I didn't understand that concept. And number two, I was not a normal person, and I still am not a normal person. I'm humble, thank God, enough to recognize that I have no proof yet that I'm a normal guy, and therefore I'm not trying to experiment and see if I can do what a normal person can do, which is enjoy a little masturbation, a little porn once in a while, and see if that doesn't affect my life. Which brings me to today's topic, which is wet dreams. And it's kind of ironic that I'm talking about wet dreams on a call where there's one man and one woman on the call today. This is an open call. Anybody can call in, which is why it's not a good recovery setting, because guard your eyes, the big deficiency that guard your eyes has, which makes it impossible to be a true recovery setting. The big deficiency which guard your eyes has, which makes it impossible for guard your eyes to be a true recovery setting for addicts, is that it's an open setting. Anybody can be listening in, and you never know who they are because they're not showing their face. They're not becoming vulnerable. There's total invulnerability. And since there's total invulnerability, you're not vulnerable on the call in any way, shape, or form to the other caller. So you're not going to grow. You cannot grow if you're not vulnerable. All growth, all the greatest things in life come through vulnerability. And that's the one thing that's sacrificed on Guard Your Eyes. And in any setting where nobody sees the other person, nobody knows the other, you don't know each other, you just talk about yourselves, but without any exposure and vulnerability. And that's okay, because in a setting like this, vulnerability would probably be dangerous, would probably be unsafe, and would probably be a bad idea, because there are other people on the line and on the forum and on the website who are also not being vulnerable, so they're dangerous. So it's not, you know, the Eitzah here isn't for people to go telling their first and last names, where they live, who they are, etc., and becoming vulnerable. That's not going to help you get any recovery whatsoever. What's going to help you is to join with other safe people who are being vulnerable in a safe environment
where nobody who's not getting vulnerable is invited. Nobody who isn't getting invited, the only people who can be there, physically can be there, are people, other people who are making themselves vulnerable as well, like a face-to-face Sexaholics Anonymous meeting, or what Guard Your Eyes is trying to do, these face-to-face Guard Your Eyes meetings. You know, obviously, any place where anybody can just call in, sit behind a phone and not use their name is not going to be a safe place. And for the two people who want to use their name, they're not safe in front of the six other people who are on the phone line who aren't using their name. So it'll never be a safe environment, a place like this. You got to come into a room. And if you're not using your real name coming face-to-face in a room, at least you're bringing your face without a bag on it. There's no disguise, you know? So at least that much is going on. So there's some measure of vulnerability, and that vulnerability makes it a sincere and true place of recovery. It's the only ingredient that's missing. It's the most important ingredient. So here we have two people coming on this particular call at this particular time, and they spoke up. Each one of them spoke up, making themselves a little bit vulnerable, and with the knowledge that it's just me and you too. You know, come on, this is a worldwide call. I mean, it's very unlikely that you're husband and wife, or brother and sister, or that you know each other. You know what I mean? So, you know, at all, or that you're in the same area or country, even, who knows? But, you know, so there's that safety net, so to speak, of the, you know, Guard Your Eyes style safety net. Well, you can't figure out who I am, so so I'm safe, you know. So okay, that's preserved, you know, which is nice, I guess. Doesn't help that much in recovery, but it's more comfortable. And yet here we are, and the question being asked is, the topic being discussed is wet dreams, Nicre Lila. In other words, nocturnal emissions, they call it in the English. Ejaculating in your sleep, or having sex in your sleep, in other words, with just nobody, with just yourself. So the Sifrei Kodesh talk about that, and it's ironic because it doesn't typically happen to women. there's no such thing as zero of Atala for a woman, you know, herself, you know. There's no such thing. Girls never deal with that Shaila of, you know, well, sperm came out. Oh, no, I thought I was having sex with somebody. I woke up and it was nobody. It was just a dream. You know, girls don't. And then, you know, the embarrassment and the shame inside and the feeling like I'm a piece of crap. And it's like, you know, this depressing feeling that every guy who's, you know, trying to be okay knows. And the truth is, even a guy feels it too. Sorry to shock the oilum, but yes, they do. And it's because it's like a weird misa. You're devoted in the one way that a man can be devoted to another person, to another thing, and there's nobody there. That's an experience that even if women might have something like it, it's not quite the same. Now, there can be sexual experience for a woman, of course, and she can wake up and then, you know, go through that, but that's kind of rare. And for the women who do have it, it's different specifically because to the woman, it's just the experience of sex for a woman is very different than the experience of sex for a man, which, by the way, is something that it's another topic, and I don't typically talk about sex directly on this call, because I don't know if, you know, 15-year-olds are listening to this call, or, you know, 12-year-olds, or who knows who. So I mean, to some degree, I do broach the topics, because otherwise it'll be of no use to anybody. Just using the word sex isn't a problem, but talking specifically about aspects of the act itself and things like that is, I don't think it's in good taste for this particular call. That having been said, you know, the sex act itself is something that a man does. It's something that a woman is generally, it's done to her or with her. And so that's what the Gemara refers to as karka olam, And because of that, it's just a very different experience. Married guys who are really upset about how sex isn't going right usually forget completely that for the female, the whole sexual experience is very, very different. You're really asking for a favor, whereas for you, it's something that you do, like putting on fill-in or baking a cake or something. It's like you take your hands, you do something with your body, you do something with a part of your body. That's a whole different thing. It's a whole different experience. It's a different attitude. It's the male attitude. Female attitude is a whole different experience. So that has to be understood when we're talking about the topic of sex. And, of course, nocturnal, you know, emissions and, you know, wet dreams, et cetera, obviously. So it's kind of ironic that here we are talking about a topic, and there's only a man and woman on the call, and I think it's important to point that out because of the difference in the experience and the significance of that. It's very significant. The fact that something comes out of a man's body in that experience is evidence afterward. And there's a physical change in the body that remains for some time, physically. That's significant. That matters. And that matters for sex, too. And that's part of the reason why there are so many more male sexaholics than there are female sexaholics. The sex is so much more important for men. The women whose sex is overly, crazily important for, those women are usually lovesick people. They're usually people who just can't get enough of being approved of, approval, approval, approval. I need someone to prove to me that I'm wonderful and that I'm beautiful and that I'm this and that I'm that. So they want, like, you know, somebody has to do something with me, etc. But a man, it's like, I need you to accept me. I need to, you know, so they can go to all the prostitutes in the world. They're not going to get what they want because they can use their hand. They can do things to themselves. They're not going to get what they want. It's never going to go away because they don't know how to love. If you don't know how to love, truly love, then how are you going to have any kind of sex that's going to be satisfying to that thing in you that says, I want you to accept me and want me? All the fantasy magazines and the schmutz, why do you think the porn is so powerful for a guy? There's no woman there. It's stupid. But why does it work? Well, it works because I pretend that there's a woman there when I use, you know? Thank God I haven't had to in 20 years. Thank God I haven't had to. Thank God. One day at a time. But when I do, that's how it is. When an addict uses porn, even a non-addict uses porn, what's the good thing? The thing is that it's turning on pathways in the brain of acceptance, being desired, being loved, wanted. You know, go ahead, you know. That's the pathway. It's like, go ahead and, you know, that's so precious to the guy, and it's all fantasy. And then afterward, it doesn't satisfy because it's not real. So how's he supposed to have it with his wife? Well, if sex is being used for her, you know, so then, and there's no escape from that because physically that's what it is. So then how does it become an act of love? How does it become something where he's really wanted and it's really accepted and he really feels loved and all this stuff? And how does she feel like everything's fine and things are the way that they're supposed to be? You know, and I'm getting exactly what I thought I was getting and this is wonderful. How does she feel that way if something's being done to her body? So that only comes when you're free from lust. You know, for an addict, for a normal person, I can't discuss because I don't know. I don't have that experience. But for an addict, that only happens. Satisfying sexuality only happens when you're free of sexuality. You know, when it's not a requirement. Oh, I haven't had sex for 3 days. I need to have it now. Come on, this is your part of the bargain. You're supposed to. What's the matter with you? How can I go so long? I'm going to come to an Aveira, you know, all this stupidity. That's what makes the sex unsatisfying because it's fake sex. It's not real sex. It's not two people loving each other, giving themselves to Vayeda Adam Chava Ishto, you know, it's not knowing each other. It's not closeness. It's a job. It's a job that has to be done, and you owe me payment, and that's all it is. You know, and that's it. It can't be satisfying. It can't be satisfying for the woman. It can't be satisfying for the man. Now, so what turns out is this explains why the more a guy loves his wife in every way besides sexually, the more she's going to be in the mood to be sexual with him. Because, not because it's more time, her hormones are building up, or other stupid ideas. That's not the point. The point is, that may happen as well. I don't know. But, and the same thing may happen for the guy. The more he lets it go, the nicer it's bound to be. The reason is different. The reason is because it's not about me doing this act to somebody, and it might as well be you because it's mutter for me to do it with you. What kind of crazy thing is that? That's a relationship, that's love, where, you know, that's what Hashem wanted it to be like, you think? Well, it's also for me to do it with anybody else. I got to do it, and it might as well be with you because it's mutter. How do I have a part in that? How is that personal at all? How do you know that he wouldn't be doing it with somebody else if she came along? Or that she wouldn't be doing it with somebody else if he came along, you know? So it's because the love is there. And it's non-gimme, gimme, gimme sexual. It's non-sexual love. The love is really there. The intimacy, honesty between the two people is really there. And the need for the sex is not there. There's some degree, maybe not total. Okay, I understand that. That's asking for too much for a human being, but maybe not total, you know, total like for, you know, 5 years or whatever. But at least in the immediate sense, there's a clear comprehension of each party that sex is now a choice. I'm choosing, you know, I'm choosing to do this. She's saying to herself, I'm choosing to do this because he's choosing to do this. It's a choice. It's not a necessity that has to happen eventually because it's been 3 days already. It's been a week. It's been 2 weeks. It's been a month. It's been this. It's been that. It doesn't matter. No. This is a choice. He could. He couldn't. It's a choice. That's where the relationship comes in this situation. And where the difference between the man and the woman, and she's being used, he's doing something, that becomes irrelevant now because it's two people making a choice. That does not happen in a sexaholic's marriage ever until the sexaholic is sober. You know, giving up the porn and the masturbation, instead of making it harder to do that, it makes it easier to do that. Instead of making it harder for sex to be a choice in the marriage, it makes it easier for sex to be a choice in the marriage. It's for a sexaholic, letting it go is how we win. That's what the alcoholics say about alcohol. Let it go so you win. When you let the stealing erotic pleasure go, when you let it go, stop fighting it, stop trying to control it and enjoy it. Because whenever you try to control yourself, what you're doing is you're trying to enjoy it to some degree and control so that it never goes too far, so that it's not nispashe chutza, you know. It doesn't work that way for an addict. Freedom makes it all a choice. And if you have that freedom, then the other partner will desire you. If you don't have that freedom, the other partner won't desire you. So the average guy thinks, no, if she feels like, sex, no, I don't care. You, nah, I don't care. then she'll be very depressed, and she wants me to show her that I desire her and stuff. And the same thing the other way around, that the wife thinks that the man wants me to show that I desire him, and that's it. If that doesn't happen, so then it's tragic. And it's like, no. That's true, but it has to be gebuoyant on a yesod. It has to be built on a foundation of choice. I choose you, you know? That's what it has to be built on. When there's no choice, then the whole thing doesn't start. The whole equation doesn't begin yet. And that's what needs to be understood. And that's the missing piece. And that's why all these discussions don't really get anywhere in this topic of what dreams, you know, or any other topic. I'm not getting anywhere. Well, because we have to have a foundation here where we're building this on a foundation. So now specifically talking about the wet dreams issue. What's a guy supposed to do? How does he deal with the depression and the feeling of the whole thing and all that? What is I can't remember exactly what the question was specifically. I think the question the fella asked was, what does he do about that? Like, just in general, how does he deal with masturbating in his sleep, or, you know, Mikre Lila, even if he didn't touch himself, you know, whatever. How does he deal with that? So I think that was the question. So, it was a guy who's in recovery who was asking, I think. And he was saying, what does that mean regarding my sobriety? Did I lose my sobriety? Did I not lose my sobriety? What does that mean? So for a Guard Your Eyes guy who's on the 90-day chart, whatever it is, first of all, most guys on Guard Your Eyes, and gals probably too, are not addicts. The overwhelming majority are not addicts. But for those who are, because you have a Yetzirah, you have sex, sexuality, it's a hard combination. It's, you know, it's normal for people to have to sin. We're a lot of Rishoyim, you know, going around. If you look at the different definitions of what a Rasha is, and it's, you know, al tistaka, you know, a person shouldn't see, mesim atzmo Rasha. This is, you don't, but in Pirkei Avos it says you shouldn't see yourself as a Rasha ever. So, okay, fine. So, I understand that. It's not nice to say such a thing. But Lamaisa, we sin, you know. If you look through the Yom Kippur davening, you'll see it's like, you know, it says we're sinners and all this stuff. Is that only for Yom Kippur? All of a sudden, after Yom Kippur, we're tzaddikim. We're you know, that's ridiculous. So yeah, we're sinners. Yeah, we do a lot of this stuff and we do things wrong. But so yeah, that doesn't make a person an addict. 250 million Americans probably a year are going to R-rated movies with sex scenes in them. That doesn't mean that they're sex addicts, all of them. You know, close to 300 million Americans, or 200 million, at least 200 million Americans get drunk a couple times a year at like a Super Bowl or something, or at a party once, and that doesn't make them alcoholics. So, necessarily, you know what I'm saying? I doubt that there are supposed to be 200 million people. Everybody has desire. And all you guys who think like, oh, Goyim, they're all addicts. You know? And Yidden, it's very rare. I just want to tell you, the statistics are quite the opposite. Sexaholics Anonymous, true addicts, Sexaholics Anonymous members, in areas where there's a firm community, is expanding and growing beyond any other fellowship, probably. And the numbers are crazy. And that's worldwide. And the last Sexaholics Anonymous convention, international convention, was in Yerushalayim. Well, not the last one, but the one before the last one, was in Yerushalayim. So, because it's growing by leaps and bounds, and also among the from meetings that I've been to. I'm not talking about the overwhelming majority, but a small majority, at least, of among the frum, it's probably 51, 60%, 51 to 60% of the frum guys who end up coming to Sexaholics Anonymous meetings have been to prostitutes. Among the goyim, 51 to 60% have never been to prostitutes. It's just porn and masturbation. And this comes as a shock to the average guy who goes, oh, he's a goy. Why would he want to come to SA at all? Of course they don't have the problem. Of course only you didn't have the problem. Because by a guy, it's fine. It's like, no. No. I've been in meetings for 20 years. And I know marriages that break up by goyim. Goyish marriages that break up more often break up over pornography and masturbation. You know. And yidden too. Same thing by goyim. Same thing. No difference. Pornography and masturbation destroys the marriage. Not because of some magical thing that happens with pornography, but just because the wife can't stand living with this guy. And who's lying to her and looking at doing things with other women in his mind, and it infects their sex and everything. He can't stand it. And there's a difference between, and they understand there's a difference between enjoying it once in a while and this, and that they're okay with, which a yid, of course, isn't, because it's, you know, but they know that that's the wives and the spouses, husbands of these people who are doing it compulsively. They know this is not just enjoying it. This is compulsing. This is more important than me to this, to my spouse. And they know it. It's true. And that's what destroys the marriage. So regardless of whether they're yidden or goyim or anything. So getting back to the thing. So what is it? So what does it mean if a guy has a wet dream? Of course, you didn't lose your sobriety because you had a wet dream. And Sexaholics Anonymous, our definition of sobriety is not, you know, it doesn't include a wet dream. But, I mean, in other words, a wet dream isn't a violation of sobriety, and you know, that I've ever heard of among any other SA member. And I'm not speaking for SA. I'm just speaking as an SA member here. This is not an SA call. I don't speak for SA. The only thing that speaks for SA is the group conscience of SA. In the literature that we have all agreed on, well, not all, but by majority agreed on, does express the view, you know, the position of SA on any topic. And SA doesn't have any business definition, you know, desire or place to define, you know, or have an opinion on any outside topic. So I don't speak for SA here. But what I am saying is that I've never met anybody who's defined their sobriety that way. So, yeah, if somebody has a wet dream, so then obviously it'll bother them. But the thing that's significant here is why the thing that's significant is how do you behave the rest of the day? I'm not talking about Al Tahara Adam Bayom Shema Yavo Lide Keri Balaila. I'm not talking about that. Although that's obviously good sense, good common sense. I'm talking about how does a person fear Zuck in the rest of their day? Are you living in a recovery dick away? Are you admitting what happened to you to your fellows? You know, you're a person in recovery. You're asking this question as a man in recovery, you know. How do you fear Zuch? This is if the way that you behave when you have one of these experiences, if the way that you respond is by opening up to your friends, telling the truth to safe people, not to klep on Bima and Shul. That won't do you any good or anybody any good. It's silly. It's not just crazy because it'll destroy you, and that's not the point. Of course it will. Of course it's crazy. Of course it'll hurt you more than it'll help you. But it'll hurt everybody more than it'll help anybody because they don't understand what you're talking about. The people in the shul who are going to hear, they're probably masturbating themselves as well, but they don't admit it, some of them, and some of them are not, and they're not going to understand. The ones who are going to go, ugh, you're a terrible person, you should be ashamed of yourself because they need to cover it up. Kala poiso b'mumma poiso. But the ones who don't understand aren't going to be able to help you, they're not going to understand. So it's a lose-lose for everyone. But among your safe fellows who are in recovery, for you to open up and tell them the truth, this happened to me last night. This behavior, this thing that happened to me, ejaculating without, you know, having sex with my wife in a normal sexual relationship, that's not part of the way I want to live now. that's just not part of the way I want to live now, whether it happens by accident or not. It doesn't matter. That's not the part. That's not how I want things to be. I don't want my sexuality to be expressed in any other way except in a normal, healthy way. And that's not expressing my sexuality. That's just some weird bodily function thing going on. That's not what I want. So, and expressing that in your meeting, you know, that this happened to me, and this is, you know, and if you can't do it in your meeting, then with your friend, with your close friend, a sponsor. And I don't mean guard your eyes sponsor. I don't know anything about guard your eyes sponsors. I'm not sure what that word even means. If your sponsor and you know each other personally, so then fine. That's at least something. But if you just know each other as Shuva 613 and, you know, Gingerbread Man, so now, you know, this is a fake relationship. If it's a fake relationship, honesty to each other is not honesty because you're not being honest to anyone. There's no one there, really. There really isn't. There's no vulnerability. And that's where everything stems from, vulnerability. Everything. People who are extremists, fanatics, they become extremists. And I've met from Yidden even, who have the answers for everything. They believe there's no question they can't answer, and not just that they can't answer, but that their Torahs that they're familiar with answer all the questions. Oh, if you would only understand, open up chapter X, Y, and Z of such and such a sefer, and you'll see, you know. They have all the answers. You got to run from such people. You got to run. You know, always search for the truth, but run from the person who says that they found it all. They know it all. Found some truth, that's beautiful, you know. Even Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai himself, at the end of his life, didn't know if he was being led to Gan Eden or Gehenim. He himself didn't know, and he's the Rebbe who you're going to come to, and you're going to say, "Oh, Rebbe, I have this problem." He's going to know your Shorash Neshama and where you're going and what you're supposed to do and what you're here and what you're there. Everything about you, he knows. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai himself didn't know if he's going to heaven or hell. What's going on? What's going on here? We're human beings. You're not supposed to know everything. You know, the Rebbe is privy because of the bracha from the Rabbanu Shlom to the tzaddik to know all kinds of things. But he's not God. He doesn't know everything. He's not perfect. You know, so. So now, you're not perfect either. Time to accept that. Things happen to me because I'm not perfect yet. And I got a long way to go. God has a long way to go with me, obviously. You know? And if I can admit that and make it part of my living day, then when I wake up and something like that happens to me, it can actually propel me to a better living, to having a better day. A more meaningful day, a more honest day. The opposite is true when a person walks around with the guilt and the shame and the self-disgust of having a wet dream, and it'll just lead them to acting out more and more because they're isolating, because of the isolation. So a wet dream is really an opportunity to de-isolate myself. If that happens to me, it's an opportunity for me. I'm not going to go consider, well, why did it happen? Let me go analyze, how could this happen to me? Usually it's obvious. You know, if you're lusting your brains out, it's pretty obvious that the reason it happened to you is because you were lusting your brains out. You're looking for an opportunity to have, you know, some sex and stuff. It didn't come, and I went, okay, that's kind of obvious. Okay, fine, so accept yourself. That's the truth about me. It's usually pretty obvious. If it's really completely unobvious, you haven't been fantasizing, you haven't been having any trouble, and it's happening to you anyway, then you know what it is? It's an opportunity for you to be honest with your fellows. It's an opportunity for you to be vulnerable and open with safe people. You know, like I have, Baruch Hashem, in an SA meeting. They're safe people. They're not going to laugh at me or look down at me, no matter what I do, because they've either done the same thing themselves at some other time or because they've experienced something very much like it themselves or because they just love me because I'm a fellow addict, so we love each other, you know? one of the things that he writes, the Piyaz Etzner, Hashem Yinkom Dama, the great tzaddik of the Rosh Chovos HaTalmidim and other svarim, who was killed in the Warsaw Ghetto after losing his children, basically. It's a horrible, horrible situation with him. But the great tzaddik of Piyaz Etzner, one of the things that he wrote was this little sefer called B'nei Machshav HaTovah, which is a setting for a musarvad, so to speak, a chassidish musarvad. You know, similar to what the B'nai Musar people would call, Tanuas and Musar people would call a Musarvad. But he was Chassidish, obviously, and didn't call it Musar. But the, because it wasn't, it was Chassidish and Aliyah and Avodas Hashem, etc. One of the things, he has a bunch of ground rules. One of the basic ground rules there is that everybody sees themselves as an equal in this room, no matter what happens. Not just now, walking in, paying forward, you know, moving forward, we consider ourselves equals. No, you can admit things about yourself. I don't see you as lower than me. That's not how we operate in this group. We're people who come together for a purpose. What we did, what we didn't do, what I did last night, what I did the day before, what I do tomorrow, that doesn't affect my standing in the group. I'm an equal. And not only that, but there is no leader, including himself, who's in the group. And even the one leading isn't considered like leading. Even the one who's like the Rebbe in the group or whatever isn't considered the leader or greater than anybody else in the group. This was the foundation stone of recovery in all 12-step groups all over the world. You know? I mean, this is the basic understanding of one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. It's the same kind of a mindset. You know, there's no, which, by the way, in Kelam, you know, they were mocked at, I think it was in Kelam, that they were mocked at, not with that, it might have been Slobodka, but I think it was Kelam. They were mocked at not to call people up for an aliyah with harav, da-da-da, even if the person was the mashgiach himself of the yeshiva. They were mocked at to just use the name and that's it. Not harav this, not harav that. Why? Hey, why? You know? What about Kavodat Torah? You know? Why? So the point is, because in this setting, yes, it's true, in Yiddishkeit, in a general sense, there is such a thing, and it's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. Don't point it. Don't put it down. Don't, you know, Kavodat Torah, the levels, Madregas, this. But guess what? Not here. In this room, in this Beis Medrash, in this Musar Yeshiva, in Kelam, we don't do those divisions because that's the seat of arrogance. That's the seat of arrogance, isolation of one person from the other, and will ultimately destroy not our Avodas Hashem Stam, but what we're trying to accomplish here in this Musar Yeshiva. That's why in that Musar Yeshiva they didn't use the titles. Not because it's wrong. You're not going to open up a sefer and prove to me that it's wrong. It's what we're trying to accomplish here is different. You know, in Nevardak, it's well known. One of the practices they did was they went into chicken stores and they asked for nails. Why? Because you look stupid. But if in the town the people know that, oh, those are the Nevardakers, he's going to come in and ask for nails. Hello, can I have some nails? And the guy leaves the store, ha, 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 ha. And he goes, yeah, I know, you're just trying to break your covet and stuff like that. And it's all part of a game. It's not going to work. If the cat's out of the bag, it's all a game, then it's not going to work. So then how did they do it? They did it when it really was truly embarrassing because it was truly stupid to ask for this thing in this store. You know it's not here. You look like an idiot. And they did it specifically in order to learn how to not care, like it says in the first Siman in Shulchan Aruch about the Mal'igim Malav, not to care. Just not to care about what other people think of me. That concept itself is at the root of Stoicism, the good part of Stoicism, and it's at the root of freedom, of just being a free man or woman. How do you have freedom with codependence? And if you don't have any codependence, if you have complete freedom, because you can be who you are and you're not afraid to to just be who you are, because you've lost, you've given up. I know that most of people would like to say broken, but in 12 steps we would say because you've surrendered, you've given up. You've already surrendered up your pride. So now why isolate from safe people? Why isolate from safe people? What is, you know, how is it going to hurt me for the truth to be known among safe people? Yeah, oh, it's, I have to save face, it's my ego. We gave that up. We're in the act, in the process of giving up our ego, you know? So let's not get carried away here with ego. Let it go. The Stoics knew that. You know? How else do you search for truth if the truth has to be something that everybody else agrees with? Then you don't have the freedom of mind to search for truth or behave in a truthful fashion, and you have to isolate yourself. And that's the shame from a wet dream that a guy is going to have, and it's going to make him isolate. Instead, to go, you know, to go. Find safe people you can open up with. Open up and say, you know what, I had a wet dream, you know. And it was last night. And boy, does it hurt. I just feel like dirty. I feel ashamed. It's weird. It kind of reminds me of those thousands of times that I masturbated myself. And I know I didn't masturbate myself. I know I didn't. But it feels like that. It wakes up that whole chemistry in my body again. And it's like, and that's part of my disease. That's sick. That's not healthy that it does that to me. You know, why do I have to suffer from, you know, some of the shame when I didn't do anything wrong, you know? And then it turns me into what? It turns me into a guy. What happens to a guy who acts out sexually? He's going to act out again, or a girl, or a woman who acts out sexually. What's going to happen to her? She's going to act out again. It's the biggest segula that there is to acting out again for an addict. Abstinence is the biggest segula for not acting out. If you just leave it, you just surrender it, you just leave it, then the compulsion will go away. But if you give in partially, you're screwed. Finished. So, and if you give in all the way, it makes you even worse. Even worse. If you give in partially and you're all crazy and this and that, giving in and getting it over with isn't going to help you. Or me. It's not going to help. It's just going to make it worse. Just going to make it worse. I need to de-isolate. The guard your eyes way is, unfortunately, fight even stronger if you gave in partially. Now's the time to remember that the Mashiach and the Rabbani Shalom and here and there and blah, 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 blah. Fight as hard as you can. That's the guard your eyes way that you read about. I mean, I don't know if it's the guard your eyes way, but it's certainly what they would advise a person on guard your eyes, right? You know that. Come on. Why do they do that? Because they're not talking to addicts. Guard your eyes is not really for addicts. Guard your eyes is great advice and chizuk for non-addicts. For addicts, we don't have the solution on guard your eyes. 12 steps has a solution. Therapy has a solution. There's medication solution. There's other solutions, but guard your eyes itself, what are you going to do? Fight. Well, you know, the addicts know, though, that, you know, if it's over, you know, if the more I act out, the more I'm going to want to act out. So what do you do? What do you do? How do you fight it? How do you win? Well, number one, erstens, stop isolating. Isolating, gewalt, but I am gingerbread man on guard your eyes. How do you expect me to say my name on the forum? No, the forum's not a safe place for you. One-on-one in a therapist's office is a safe place. Walking into an SA meeting is a safe place. You know, if you think you're a sexaholic and you're going to be vulnerable with everyone else, then the meeting remains safe. But if you're going to walk in just to bathe in the goodies that they have, you're not going to gain very much, and you're going to create an unsafe place in the meeting. And Baruch Hashem, we've been saved from that so far. May Hashem continue to protect us. So opening up to other people. You want to preserve your sobriety and your recovery and stuff, even though you had a wet dream. Open up to other people. Stop being ashamed. Lose the shame. Lose the shame. I want to just ask, there's a beautiful Maisa with one of the Chassidish Rebbes, that the Rebbe Melech maybe, or the Levi Yitzchak, I always confuse them, even though they were very different. But anyway, this tzaddik was embarrassed publicly, and he rejoiced. He was happy. And someone said to him, what are you so happy about? He goes, oh, because look what a kapara I'm achieving, and the olam haba, and this and that. It didn't bother him anymore, so I'm asking you a question. If it doesn't hurt him anymore, it doesn't bother him anymore that he got embarrassed, so then where's the kapar? Right? It doesn't hurt you. You don't feel ashamed. You don't want to hide under the ground and dig a hole for yourself. You don't feel the pain. So then, obviously, the kapara and the conversion from one state to another in Madregas or whatever, in a case where somebody was, Mavuyash Barabim, comes from the pain of the busha itself. But if he realizes that it's a tremendous kapara and it's a wonderful thing and he's happy, he doesn't care. He's happy that he's embarrassed publicly. Then how is he embarrassed publicly? Where's the embarrassment now? Gone. The pain is gone. The feeling of busha is gone. So there are two answers. First of all, the feeling of busha can't be gone until a person is, even what do we say, kavod abrias, by a dead man? We say kavod abrias, this tremendous kavod abrias things all of a sudden. What happens to a live person? We give far more kavod to a dead body than we give to a live person. A live person, you curse at, you yell at him, you treat it, but a dead person, you put a candle by his head, everybody has you have a shimer, it's silent, you don't eat in front of him, you don't do anything that he can't do in front of him because of loyeg la rush, you don't do this, you don't do that. All of a sudden we're respecting a dead person much more than you would ever respect your mother-in-law or your this or your that. So you have to respect the person, I lost my train of thought here. I'm so sorry. Hey, what was I saying? And I'm just finishing up too. Okay. I lost my train of thought here. I'm trying to think out loud to get back to where I was. I'm sorry. Where's the kapara if there's no more embarrassment? Why the tremendous hakpadas in kavod ames for a dead person that you don't even have for a live person? Because imagine if you passed out in public. If you had a seizure, an epileptic seizure in public. What's the first thing that happens to epileptics after their seizures, besides the fact that they feel very, very sleepy, like a grand mal, like a major seizure? What happens to them? They're embarrassed. Let's talk to them. When they know it happened in the middle of a store, they started falling on the ground and shaking back and forth, and their body arches back, and then they curl up into a ball and they scream and vomit might come out of their mouths and they arch back again and uncontrollable jerks and vomiting. And some of them might have lost bowel and bladder, whatever they call it, incontinent. They become incontinent sometimes. And it's a horribly, horribly embarrassing state for a person to be in, horribly. And that's one of the tremendous problems that these people have. They become so withdrawn after that because of the shame. So withdrawn. Why? Because they had no control. They had no bodily control over themselves. Like a dead person who just lays there. Imagine you're ruach, you're floating over your dead body, after 120. You're floating over it and you have... And there it is laying there, and who knows what's coming out and what's happening with it and this. And you're unconscious with your mouth open laying there, and people see you. Ugh, it's embarrassing. So the kavod hames is because of sensitivity that we have. We have tremendous sensitivity to a person who's dead because they can't control themselves. And it's embarrassing to be in that kind of a state. So you see what's the embarrassment over here. You know, you see the power of shame and embarrassment. So I'm asking you a question. What's the kapara if the person is already appreciating that he was embarrassed publicly? So then he's no longer being embarrassed publicly, and there's de facto
no kapara.
His kapara disappears as well. So the end of that, Maisa, is that number one, you're still a human body and you still have sambusha. That's unerasable. That can't be completely erased. So yes, there will be a little bit of busha of some kind. When someone else makes me the victim or I do something I can't control or stop, that's what the yisod of, like, the shame of a dead person is. So that's on one hand. On the other hand, sorry about the background noise. On the other hand, the issue over here is that going through the act of being embarrassed itself is a chance for growth, and that's a kapara. In other words, going through the situation where someone shames me in public, it calls up the same chemicals and stuff in me. That's not going to go away just by itself. True. But the second part of it is that it's an opportunity for me, the person who is shamed, it's an opportunity for me to see and let go, to recognize my ego and let it go and say, you know what? It's okay. You know, I'm free. I'm not all bound up now because, what did he do? Look what he did to me. No. I can let go of all that. I can let go of that. That's an opportunity for growth. It's not just I'm getting a ton of olam haba for this. It's a wonderful deal. Really? That completely erases the pain? Totally erases the pain of the embarrassment? That's not what the tzaddik meant. But the tzaddik meant that it makes it worth it for him to let go of his ego and to grow. That's the chiddush. He didn't have no ego and no pain. Of course he was embarrassed like crazy. Maybe not as much as others because he let go of tons of his ego, as all our real tzaddikim do. Except that's not the point. The point is that this was an opportunity. This thing that happened to him was an opportunity for him to let go of yet another chunk of his ego and his self, his chametz that's blowing him up, you know, puffing him up. He became more and more like matzah, a little bit more, another shtick gaiva gone, you know, a little more kasher l'Pesach, a little more each time. That's the point. And that's what he was rejoicing over, I think. And that's what happens to you. If you have a wet dream, you have the chance to let go of this shame of, you have the chance to let go of that shame. And to do it in a kosher, meaning sensible way, among safe people. Not to clap on the bima, Chalila. That's a stupid way to do it. But to really do it because, you know, out of sensitivity and maturity and clarity, you know, growing up, that's a beautiful way to do it. It's not a destruction of your sobriety. What it is it's an opportunity for you to grow up and outgrow that whole thing. That's all it is. It's a gift from the Rabbono Shlom. That's what it is. It's a gift from the Rabbono Shlom. And personally, if you can go to the mikveh in a healthy way, you know, I personally would, because thank God I can go to the mikveh in a healthy way. There are some guys who can't go to the mikveh in a healthy way, so what they need to do is they need to make sure that they go to the mikveh when there's nobody else there, which is very easy to do in the middle of the day, at certain times, even in a place where it's a chassidish place and they go to the mikveh all the day, you know, different tefillos and stuff, but you can find time when it's really quiet and you can go. You know, Or you can go to the beach, you know, go to a kosher beach area, you know what I mean, and go there, you know, I don't know, loosen your bathing suit. And by the way, you can go into a mikveh wearing a bathing suit. If going to a mikveh is uncomfortable for you, obviously you can't do this with people there because they'll think you're crazy, but if you're alone and going walking around naked in the mikveh is a problem for you, so then you can wear a bathing suit, al pi halacha. You just loosen it when you go into the mikveh yourself. Okay, maybe it's a little weird, I don't know. But if that's something that works for you, then you got to know yourself and be honest with yourself. That's part of growing up, is being honest with yourself. You know? So, you know, thank God, you know, that's very rare that somebody needs to do that. But some people have been very triggered in mikvahs and have a terrible, terrible problems in mikvahs. So, you know, yeah. Go if that's going to help you feel more clean and feel happier and with yourself and all that. Why not? Go to the mikveh. Why not? Why not? You know? Why not? And as far as all these tikkun klalis and all these things, and that's part of the whole thing. You know, if it helps you, it helps you. But it's probably just going to trigger the whole Meshigana guilt thing again. That's probably all it's going to do. And for many people, going to the mikveh is going to do the same thing. It's going to trigger the whole guilt thing again. So it might be a horrible thing for you to do to go to the mikveh. I don't know. You know, so you need to judge that for yourself. Everybody has to judge for themselves and know themselves. That's part of being a human being, is to know yourself and be true to yourself. You know? So anyhow, thanks for letting me share. On such a sensitive topic for you and whoever else. Hope that everything that was said comes out okay for people who are listening. If you have any comments and you want to share different things with me or for me to bring up in future calls to share with the Ilam, number one, you can speak up on the call and just say them if you wish. When you come on, it says this call is being recorded. So you can't be on the call and be recorded if you don't know it. So, you know, you can only be recorded. I mean, you will always know it if you're being recorded because the lady's voice on the recording will tell, on the phone line when you come on, will tell you this call is being recorded. So if it doesn't say that, that means it's not being recorded. So anyway, in addition, you can also email me. My email is wequitehiding, and then the numeral 2@gmail.com. We quit hiding. The numeral 2. We quit hiding 2@gmail.com, and you can just email me your comments, questions, suggestions, feedback, whatever it is that you like. Have a great day. Have a fantastic day. Hatzlacha to everybody.